Get ready for an all-new Hardline segment. It's time to step into the snake pit. And now, with something completely over the top, the host and star of the Snake Pit, Snake.
Bouncer.
American League Detective.
Dirks Bentley.
Listen, I'm sorry.
Told you.
When I see Dirks, I'm like,
not
IRK.
Dirks. Dirks. All right, so Davey, this one is specifically for you, but it's also for everybody out there who is kind of akin to what's going on in our control room, which is anywhere from the age of 26 to 36 or so. Because 40 years ago this week, I think we had the greatest concert ever put on. And it just so happened to be also the most successful charity concert of all time. And that is Live Aid. And
yes.
For those who don't know, this was the most ambitious, crazy, I cannot believe the organizers pulled this off type event. And you look back at it and you see 40 years later that the bands that were considered legacy acts at the time, almost all of them are still playing, is weird.
Yeah. And the fact that they were able to pull this off on two continents.
Yeah.
In the early 80s.
Okay, so origin story. Bob Geldof is the guy, you may not know the name, but you would know he's the guy that wrote the Do They Know It's Christmas? He and his writing partner in this British band known as the Boomtown Rats, they put together the year prior the Do They Know It's Christmas song. And Bob Geldof, on October 23rd of 1984, was watching TV, and the BBC ran a 9-minute or 6-minute report on what it called biblical famine, and it was the story of what was going on in Ethiopia at the time. And the biblical famine was caused by drought and really, I guess, exacerbated by a civil war.
And yeah, like supply lines were cut off. And storage of food was being either hoarded or blown up by rebels,
yeah,
and all of this stuff.
And the images that we remember when we watched this as a kid, because it was instantly, you know, made its way over here, were starving Ethiopian kids with the distended stomachs and...
Yeah, the flies crawling on their eyeballs.
Dude, it was horrific.
Yeah.
We were little kids at the time, and I'm like, oh my God, are you kidding me? So Geldof is 32 years old at the time.
Did not look 32.
He did not. But imagine being 32 and having the balls and the connections to say, I'm going to start raising money. I could write a song, which he did, and do it himself. But hey, let's get all the greatest rock stars in the world to record it, which he did. That wasn't enough. He wanted to put on a concert. And so here comes Live Aid. And in his vision, like Dave said, it was a concert spanning two continents. One in the UK at Wembley Stadium in London, and the other in Philadelphia, the birthplace of America, if you will. And he wanted to get all the greatest stars at the time and some of the previous generation stars to come play a concert all for free to help raise money. And he pulled it off to the tune of 1.5 billion people watching this on TV. You had two arenas, the Vet in Philadelphia and Wembley Stadium, each holding about 80,000 people. How much were tickets, by the way?
Gosh. $50?
$35. And then some of the upper crust tickets, they were 50. Now, before you're like, well, that seems reasonable for 1985, wait till you hear the lineup. They raised more than $140 million. And again, they got all these acts to come do this for free. Whatever they were doing at the time, to go to London, hopefully they were there already, or go to Philadelphia, maybe they were there already, or in the area at least, in the states, to get them all to show up to make sure. And look, all of these people, they promised to do it, and they all followed through, which, again, is a miracle that they agreed to do this.
Right, because musicians are notorious flakes.
Yeah, 100%. So if you had MTV at the time, it was all broadcast on MTV and on ABC. But MTV had the majority of it, the cool parts, the interviews and everything, because that's what they did. This was the high watermark for MTV.
Yeah.
They had all their VJs there. They were interviewing, you know, all the famous people. They were airing all the shows, and it was all day long. And so in London, of course, they're a little bit ahead of us. So everything started early in the morning in London. And here is who played. And I'm going to leave out a few acts, but I'm going to give you the big acts. Here is who played the London show. Elvis Costello, earlier in the morning, U.S. time. Sting, Phil Collins, Brian Ferry with David Gilmour from Pink Floyd, Paul Young, who was big at the time, and then here comes the heavy hitters, and this was all in succession. U2, Dire Straits, Queen, David Bowie, The Who, Elton John, Paul McCartney.
Golly.
I will repeat, this was one concert over the course of a day. U2, Dire Straits, Queen, David Bowie, The Who, Elton John, and Paul McCartney. It's absolutely amazing. So, on the other side of it, on the other side of the world.
Yeah, that's just the London part.
That's London. So in Philadelphia. So London is wrapping up, and there's a little bit of crossover, but once the evening show started, you know, 6 o'clock show started in Philadelphia, they were already finished in London. So these got obviously top billing on. I mean, this was an all day event on MTV, and I don't think I left my chair watching this. So over in the States, you had Black Sabbath, Run DMC, which I have no memory of Run DMC being a part of that, but how cool. This was really the first entree to the world.
Yeah, 1984. I mean, hip hop was still 85. It was still underground at that point.
Yeah. So Black Sabbath, Run DMC, Crosby, Stills and Nash, Judas Priest, The Beach Boys, The Pretenders, Santana, and then Madonna. And again, think of the time. Madonna, Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, The Cars, Neil Young, Eric Clapton, Phil Collins,
Concord.
He did both. Eric Clapton, Phil Collins, Led Zeppelin, Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young, Duran Duran, Mick Jagger, Bob Dylan. I mean,
that's everyone.
Yeah. Yes.
Everyone who was anyone at the time.
Yes. And I just can't believe that all this got pulled off without a hitch. So last night, I went so deep. I was up so late watching all of this because I was reading this article on Bob Geldof, who created all of this, and his recollections of it all 40 years later. And as he said, it was so easy to get all these people to do it because everybody was so bought in on what was going on over there and in Ethiopia and what a tragedy it was that it didn't take much to get all these guys on board. And the only people that didn't do it that they thought for sure were going to do it, Bruce Springsteen, who again, this is right after Born in the USA. He decided not to do it because he just didn't think it was going to be that big. He didn't realize. He's like, I regret this till the day I die that I didn't do it. Michael Jackson was caught in the studio. Prince.
With the boy.
With the boy. Prince sent a pre-tape video of a song. And other than that, pretty much everybody did it that was huge at the time. That was really the only people that didn't do it.
And I know you're probably going to mention this, but the fascinating part of it is you have that incredible lineup in both arenas, in Wembley and the Vet, but the thing that everyone remembers is Queen and Freddie Mercury being the one who stole the show from all of those people.
Yeah, and so in the movie, if you saw the movie, Bohemian Rhapsody, that came out a couple of years ago, they make mention of Live Aid, and this is the last 15, 20 minutes of the show, of the movie, was Live Aid, because it is their most iconic show. But in the movie, they make mention of the fact that the phones blew up, the donations really started to pour in when they took the stage, which Bob Geldof responded in this article by saying, that's not true at all. At all.
That's revisionist Hollywood history.
Completely. The phones blew up when David Bowie played. Bowie hadn't done anything in a while, or I guess hadn't played live in a while, and they convinced him to come out and play, and he killed it. And he played the song Heroes, which you can play. This was the last song that he played. Heroes. The crowd is... It's so cool to go back and watch this, man. It'll give you chills.
Heroes.
It'll give you chills for 3 hours straight if you want to watch enough videos. So it was really cool, but after this song, he introduced a video of, you can leave it up a little bit, it's okay, bud, you can ride a little bit. He introduced a video that was like 15 minutes long of the Ethiopian struggle that was broadcast on TV. So it was broadcast in Philadelphia, in London, and on TV. And that's what opened up the phones and made people just pour in money. Again, $140 million. But as Geldof said, Bowie was the key. And he was the guy that we wanted to introduce it. And it worked to a charm, if that's what they were going for, which obviously they were. All right, let's take a quick break. I have so much audio I want to play. Speaking of Queen, speaking of a reunited Led Zeppelin, they got Led Zeppelin to reunite, and it's crazy, crazy audio. Let's finish it up here. It's the Live Aid 40-year anniversary, and in 3 minutes, we'll come back and play it. All right. There's a little bit of Queen from Live Aid. So it's the 40-year anniversary of Live Aid. It is, I know a lot of people say Woodstock. I don't even think it's close. Like, unequivocally, this is the greatest concert ever put on. I don't know how you can deny it.
Yeah. I mean, there's certainly an argument to be made. But, I mean, Woodstock is a... It's a seminal event in music history, but it didn't benefit anyone other than the promoters.
No.
And it was just a total cluster. Whereas, like you said, this thing was an incredible undertaking and it went off without a hitch.
Yeah, I know. And, you know, just reading the lineup of these, the acts that showed up there, it's just, it's crazy. It was $35 to get in. Obviously, people, I read a bunch of accounts of people that were there when they were 15, 16 years old and just how it changed their lives and all that stuff. I mean, it's one of those things where we take for granted moments like this in pop culture and in rock and roll. So some of the audio that is out there that I wanted to play for you guys, first off from U2. So U2 was right on the edge of releasing, I think, their seminal album.
Unforgettable Fire?
No, the next one. Oh my God. I cannot believe I am blanking on. Dave, you're no help.
I am no help.
The With or Without You album. The Joshua Tree. Good God, Dave. Why are you here?
Go, Dave.
So this was before that was released, and there is no doubt, as they played before Dire Straits and Queen and David Bowie and The Who and Elton John and Paul McCartney. So they were the young act before playing in front of all these legacy acts. And this was their moment to really show, I think, that they were next. This was the next in line greatest rock and roll band of the current time. And so they played Sunday Bloody Sunday, and then they played Bad. And I don't know if people are aware of what happened during the song. So they're playing Bad, and you can play it. And they're in the back third of the song. And Bono is prancing around stage, just peacocking like you wouldn't believe. I mean, he knows that they just destroyed it out there. And they're obviously the level of staging. They're... Okay, you hear that right there? So he had gone down to the crowd level, which it took time. He was jumping over little barricades, but he did it because there was such a push from the crowd during U2's set. All these signs of U2 fans that were there to see U2. Like, seeing some of the older acts was great, but a lot of these people, it looked like, were there to see U2. And there was a girl being pushed up against the very front of the barricade, and Bono made it all the way down to the crowd, has security, and he helps pull this girl up. And then he stands there and gets, as a 16-year-old girl, and he holds her as close as he possibly can to him and slow dances with her for about a minute to calm her. It's one of the coolest, most chill-inducing moments you can see in rock and roll, that guy went down there and did that.
And then she Me Too'd him.
Yeah. I mean, her life obviously changed forever. But you crank this up.
Yeah, for the younger generation who roll their eyes at U2, or P1s who are beaten down by Craig and George worshiping U2.
Yeah.
You just...
Dude.
If you can put yourself in this time period, in the mid-80s, when they were at the height of their powers, they were important. They were huge.
Oh, beyond huge.
Like, once they got to Rattle and Hum and then
yeah.
Octoon Baby and stuff, I know that that's not where a lot of people draw the line, but to me, that's kind of where they jumped the shark. But their 80s output is impeccable.
Yeah, and they knew it. And this is pre-Edge wearing his little do-rag thing.
And yeah, before he totally lost his hair.
You can see a tiny bald spot when they're playing up there. But they killed it, man. Led Zeppelin reformed. So they obviously had lost their drummer to death.
Yeah. By the way, on my flight back from Boston, I watched Becoming Led Zeppelin on the plane.
Did you really?
Yeah.
Man, you need to introduce that to the masses.
Okay.
At some point in the summer. We have a long August ahead of us. So Led Zeppelin reformed. And this is 1985. They've been broken up for a couple of years, and they really didn't know what to do. And Bob Geldof at Live Aid convinced Robert Plant and Jimmy Page and John Paul Jones to get up there. And Phil Collins was their drummer.
Perfect.
So Phil Collins had taken the Concorde from London after he played his set and came over here to the U.S. And you hear as they get up there, Phil Collins introduces them, and then Robert Plant has trouble with his monitors, and he's like, I need a little break. And so there's a little break, and MTV is carrying this, and the MTV VJ, Mark Goodman, you hear him talking as they start to play and how excited he is.
Phil Collins on stage for what is now being called the Led Zeppelin reunion. This is the one that a lot of people have been waiting for. I'm not going to give away the whole set, but I will tell you this. That's rock and roll, and they're doing Stairway. Let's go to the stage.
All right, pause it here. So, again, it's freaking Led Zeppelin. They are on stage together, and the crowd doesn't even know what to do with themselves. And Robert Plant is just... eating it up. I mean, he's going crazy. But we talk about why Led Zeppelin really broke up. Robert Plant couldn't hit those notes. And so this is the first song, and listen to how clunky this is. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to go ahead.
So they play rock and roll, and then they start going, any requests? Any requests? And Jimmy Page starts noodling. He's got the cigarette hanging out of his mouth. It looks so badass. And you're like, what are they doing? What are they doing?
Communication breakdown?
A whole lot of love.
Yeah, a whole lot of love.
Sorry. They all sound the same.
Come on. It's such a time warp. It's so cool.
Yeah, so what I was going to mention is, so their last studio album, In Through the Outdoor, which no one really cares about, but that came out in 79, so this is 85.
Yeah.
So they had been out of mind for 6 years.
Yeah.
And think about how long 6 years was back then. Now, I mean,
it's nothing, but then, yeah, to be
gone.
That
seems like an eternity back then.
Well, and like, you know, The Who and Elton John and Led Zeppelin and Mick Jagger and McCartney, they were all right at 40. Right at it, on the number. And this is MTV, and everybody that's watching is between 12 and 18.
Right.
And most of us were just like,
who are these olds?
Yes. Who are these old people? And they defined rock and roll. And, you know, it was Queen's big moment, and I don't want to play too much from Queen, but I do think that the back and forth between Freddie Mercury, and I don't know if you guys have heard this whole thing before. A lot of it's drops that you probably heard before, whether it's on this station or, yes, Beyond. Have you ever heard the whole thing? And how it got started. So Freddie Mercury finishes their first song and the crowd's going crazy and he just owns that stage like nobody's business. And then just starts doing this back and forth with the crowd. I mean, I'm telling you, last night I was sitting there with almost tears in my eyes watching.
Right.
I've not seen these videos. I mean, besides the Queen movie, which shows a recreation of it all, I've not seen these videos probably since 1985. And a lot of it, I don't know how much I cared about seeing Mick Jagger and Tina Turner up there together or the reformation of Led Zeppelin. Like, that was later on in my life that I was like, whoa, Led Zeppelin. But then there was no internet at the beginning of it, and I've just never gone back to consume it. And every second of both of these shows of Live Aid is out there to watch. And, you know, Elton John was second to closing out the London side of things. And was it London? I can't even remember if he was London or, yeah, he was London. So it was, again, in London, it was U2, Dire Straits, Queen, David Bowie, The Who, Elton John, and Paul McCartney. And Elton killed it. And I think this was, as much as Elton kind of turned into a caricature of himself, I watched this last night, and him doing Rocket Man, and go ahead and fire it off. You talk about your fastball.
And all the science, I don't understand.
He had it going.
It's just a drive.
And listen to the electric guitar that they incorporate. I mean, all these dudes are right at 40. They've done anything and everything over the last 15 years, but they're still at the apex of what they're probably better than they were when they were 25, right?
Right. And this is just when you're in the early mid 80s, that's basically like third generation rock and roll.
Yeah.
So there isn't a template for how rock artists age.
No.
And so all of those guys who were big in the 60s and 70s, they're just trying to figure out how to stay relevant in the 80s.
Yeah.
And the fact that all of them showed up for this and galvanized so many people to give, but also gained attention and respect from our generation.
Yeah, for sure. And again, they raised $140 million, which inflation adjusted is what?
$419 million, so, yeah.
And Bob Geldof, the guy that started it all, in this article in the New York Times, he says that he was recently at a place, some hotel in somewhere in London, and he says an Ethiopian man walked up to him and said, "Can I shake your hand?" He says he then stood bolt upright. He had prepared for this, and he made a speech at me. He didn't know who his parents were in Ethiopia. He said he was raised on Band-Aid food in a Band-Aid orphanage. Band-Aid is the charity that he started, that Live Aid contributed to. He says he got to Paris to study catering, and he was now here at my hotel. I asked if he had a family. He said, yeah, he met an Ethiopian girl, and he showed me a picture of her and his two cute kids, 8 and 9. Then he suddenly rushed at me and hugged me and laid his head on my chest and said, "Thank you for my sons. Thank you for my life." And so, like, a lot of people question, like, oh, yeah, whatever, all that money, where's it even going over there? What are they even doing with it or whatever? It helped. Like, it did something. It meant something. But, yeah, that's 40 years ago, for my money, hands down the greatest concert ever. And if you were there, oh, my God, in one of those two venues, like, golly.
You got in for $50.
35.
$35.
$35.